this episode of Thinking Strategically, Vice Admiral Lou Crenshaw discusses what makes a great strategist from his perspective. Please enjoy.
Welcome to another episode of our Conversations with Strategic Thinkers and Leaders. My name is Timothy Williamson, and I am your host. Today, we're honored to feature Vice Admiral Lou Crenshaw, United States Navy retired. Let me make it clear that the views expressed here do not necessarily represent those of any particular organization, ideology, political position, nor department, agency, branch, or part of any government, and this is an unclassified discussion. This episode is brought to you by my good friends, advisors, and fellow collaborators in this effort, Brigadier General Wayne Michael Hall, United States Army retired, of www.waynemhall.com, and Dr. Edward Rockauer of the Naval Post Grad School of www.rockauer.net. And also, I'd like to encourage you to go and visit our website at www.thinkingstrategically.net. And once there, go find the link for the Navy Safe Harbor Foundation, a very good organization, one that's actually holding a gala event on the 16th of May, Saturday, to raise funds for wounded and seriously ill Navy and Coast Guardsmen. Go check it out. And once on the website, also, you can follow our webinars, podcast, blog page, and other activities. And now, let's get started. Admiral, a very interesting bio you have there. Can you give us a brief story about who you are, what you're doing, and all that kind of thing, sir?
I can. First, I want to thank you for mentioning the Safe Harbor Foundation. It's a great organization to take care of sailors and Coast Guardsmen who have been wounded or are seriously ill. So I tell people that I joined the Navy to avoid the draft in 1970. I actually went to the Naval Academy, did my 4 years on the Severn. Became a bombardier navigator in A-6s after going through flight training down in Pensacola. Spent most of my life on the operational side of the Navy flying A-6s and really enjoyed it. I had the privilege to command a squadron, an air wing, carrier battle group during my operational tours, and then was also very honored to command the Navy region in Europe and the deputy commander of naval forces in Europe. So, had a pretty good balance between operational and shore duty. I also was honored to not only be the executive assistant to then Sinclair Fleet, but also then executive assistant to the Secretary of the Navy. And when I wasn't doing anything else, I managed to do a quick stop at Test Pilot School and finish the curriculum there and do some work at the test center.
Yes, sir.
I ended up my career in the Navy as the N8. The DCNO for resources, requirements, and assessments, and then went into the private sector as a partner at the accounting firm of Grant Thornton, where I hit mandatory retirement age and retired yet again, and now have my own business.
Yes, sir. That's very good. What is your business now? I notice I've got in the background on my website here, on the page anyway, Crenshaw Consulting Associates out of McLean, Virginia.
The Crenshaw Consulting Associates is a service-disabled, veteran-owned small business.
Great.
And we focus on small businesses, helping them navigate the waters of the procurement world in not only Department of Defense, but in the federal government at large. Our specific focus is helping those small businesses that are reaching their small business revenue limits and are about to graduate into the scary world of full and open competition. And we help prepare them for that, sometimes with restructuring, some re-strategizing on how they go to market, and then help them in various capture opportunities. So that's basically what the firm does. I do a little bit of expert witness testimony on the side, generally related to contract disputes, where I provide analysis and expert opinions on budget matters.
Yes, sir. Sounds like you've had a very interesting career, and you're also thoroughly enjoying what you do now. Let's jump over to the question at hand, basically what we do here at Thinking Strategically. And the question I've posed to everyone, Admiral, has been the same one. And the reason I ask this same question, by the way, is that a multitude of perspectives enable us to understand it better. And it also may be some way, there may be part of your description and part of the way you describe things and that's important to someone out there in the world right now listening to this. So what makes a great strategist, in your opinion, Admiral?
Well, I certainly have some opinions about that, which I'm happy to share with you. I think, I guess if you count them up, there's probably seven or so characteristics, I think, that one has if they are a great strategist. And then there's probably a couple that one doesn't have. So yes. The first thing that I think is certainly important for someone who is a strategist, and this, frankly, is in the public sector, the private sector, military, wherever you are, the nonprofit sector. I think this is someone who has a long-term vision, someone who can look out past just the front door and really think about how things can be, a to-be type of person who really can help shape the thoughts about what sort of organization you want to be. You know, one of the things that I do when I talk to my clients who are generally wanting some advice and counsel on how to look forward in their business, one of the first things I ask them, so what would you think, what would you describe to me as success? If we have a successful engagement, you know, what would that success look like? And I think, you know, any undertaking you go into, particularly when you're thinking about strategy, you need to think about what's the long-term vision. Where do we want to be in 10, 15, 20 years? And it's just a matter of working back from there. So vision, I think, is very important. Someone is a long-term. I think another thing that probably characterizes a strategic thinker is something that I term someone who has new views on old news. Someone who look at some things as they've existed and not take the answer of, well, that's the way we've always done it. Someone who can come in with a fresh set of eyes, a fresh set of views on things that are existing. Because, and frankly, I think, I guess at the risk of being somewhat controversial, one of the things that always concerns me when I look at the various panels and expert things that the Department of Defense sometimes commissions when they're having problems is they just bring in all the old people. Well, those are the people like me who got us in the situation we're in the first place. And I'm not quite sure why they think, you know, we're going to have any fresh views. So I'm always concerned when I see these kinds of panels when they don't bring in people with different perspectives and different views, because many times, you know, we just collapse back into old thing.
Yes, sir.
So I'll pause for a minute to see if you have any questions on that.
No, as a matter of fact, I do like the phrasing new views on old news. That's definitely a good way of looking at it. And I happen to agree fully, and most of us do, that we do need people on these panels and on these boards who actually are thinking, you know, who are new. And really, there's no questions whatsoever, Admiral, from that regard, because we're in agreement.
an example I like to use is Secretary, AT&L Secretary Kendall in the Defense Department. Mm-hmm. Last summer, I think they commissioned a report on what's wrong and how to fix the Defense Department acquisition system. Mm-hmm. And they had a document that had essays written by about 20 or so people. Mm-hmm. But they were all people who had been in the business. There was nobody from outside. There was nobody young. Mm-hmm. There was, for instance, there was no contracting officer, nobody that had any experience in the field in writing and actually administering the acquisition system. Not one person was asked to write an essay about that. So we get the old views on the old news, frankly, and not that some of that's not valuable, but I'm more interested in what the contracting officer at NAVFAC thinks about what's wrong with the procurement system than I am about what a former Assistant Secretary of Defense thinks is wrong with it. Because people at headquarters often have great vision, but it seldom filters down into the field, and their intentions get watered down. So anyway, that's my political statement. Let's talk another thing. I think a strategic thinker is someone, and I'm going to borrow a phrase from my former boss and good friend, the former chief of naval operations, Jay Johnson, who said, it's someone who steers by the stars, not by the wake. Nice. And this also back to that vision piece, someone who not only can see where they're going, but can steer to that direction. The analogy I like to use, when I was a little boy learning how to drive, my father used to tell me, when you're driving the car, look way out ahead of the car, not down right at the front. Because if you're just looking right at the front, you're going to keep turning the steering wheel and jiggling it around back and forth. You're going to weave all around. What you need to do is pick a point out in the distance and steer smoothly from that. And so I believe firmly that those who are really strategic thinkers can look out ahead and kind of steer smoothly towards where they want to go and avoid this knee jerk. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the Pentagon that I found in my many tours in the Pentagon is in many ways you can't do any sort of strategic planning or thinking on the day's work because the early bird comes in and that governs everything that goes on for that morning. And all those plans that you had for the years and weeks ahead of what you wanted to do somehow gets overshadowed by the crisis of the day, the local thing that got reported somewhere. And now you're spending half of your day, instead of working on something strategic, fighting some forest fire. So steer by the stars, not by the wake. It doesn't do very much good to look backwards.
Yes, sir. Yeah, that reminds me of...
I think...
That reminds me of our conversation last time, Admiral. You were telling me about that. I think that's something you said that you're from Alabama.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, of course, you know, I learned how to drive when I was 5 years old, driving tractors and trucks in the fields and things.
Yeah.
But, you know, that piece of advice my dad gave me always stuck out in my mind. And I find myself now, when I put my grandkids behind the wheel and they start trying to drive a little bit, you know, I tell them, you know, look way out ahead. Don't look close in. And that tends to keep it from weaving around so much.
Right. You know, I'm located out here in Warrensburg, Missouri, which is farm country, a lot of it, but the airbase nearby. And the people out here and around the world can appreciate that fact of being able to steer by the stars, not by the wake, or the analogy you gave of looking off in the distance when you're driving a car. And then one from my association with Alabama and Missouri is that if you're driving your tractor out in the middle of the field somewhere, the thing is you don't want to be watching those two front wheels. You want to watch the tree in the distance and know where you're headed to get a straight line. So that's a great analogy.
That's right.
Very, very good analogy.
That's right. You won't be very proud of those rows if you're looking at front wheels, because they're going to be pretty crooked.
That's right. Yes, sir. So that's good.
So another thing I think strategic thinkers do or consider risk.
Mm-hmm.
They are not necessarily risk adverse, but they understand risk. They know where to take risk. They know how to mitigate risk. And I think that's so important. You know, it always amazed me that when I was, when I was an air wing commander in the operational Navy, and someone come to me with a plan, you know, one of the squadron commanding officers or strike lead, and they would brief me on a plan, and I would ask them, so what do you think the chances are that this is going to succeed? And they would say, well, maybe 50%. And that was unacceptable. You know, I'd go back and plan, mitigate more risk. Let's come up with a better plan so that, you know, eventually I would settle for a 99% chance of success kind of thing. And yet that same person, Lou Crenshaw, would go to the Pentagon and look at the budget, and I would ask someone, well, what are the chances that this is going to cost only $200 million? And they would tell me 20%. I go, okay, that's good enough. And so, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we have this disconnect in how we as leaders accept operational risk, but then we move up to the Pentagon, and all of a sudden, those of us who are very concerned about risk seem to forget about it. And a lot of that is because most of the things that are done at the Pentagon are affecting things 5, 6, 10, 15, 20 years out. and you don't feel that press to be responsible necessarily for the outcomes. I think that's one of the reasons when you look at a couple of the very successful programs in the United States Navy, the nuclear power program with Admiral Rickover, who was the person in charge for years and years and years.
Yes.
And he knew that he was going to be responsible. The same thing is true, you know, in the Aegis weapon system. You know, they put Admiral Wayne Meyer in charge of that, and his job was not just to nurse it along for 2 years, but nurse it along for decades and make sure it was successfully delivered.
Hmm.
And I like that model.
Yeah.
I think another thing that separates strategic thinkers is they're able to figure out what's hot and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to focus on the things that really matter and keep the organization focused on the things that matter and the things that are going to make a real difference, as opposed to the things that probably don't matter all that much but give the illusion of activity or the illusion of progress.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And, you know, that's a common problem, I think, on staffs and in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
Is people are working on things that are important to them, probably, but not necessarily important to the organization. The classic thing I learned, certainly in combat and then in my commercial life, is when a consultant would come running up to me and go, oh, the entire world is failing, the life as we know it is ceasing to exist. And I would say, okay, so we'll calm down. First of all, has there been an accidental nuclear detonation? Well, no, sir. Okay, has there been a death? Well, no, sir. Okay, well, then it can't be that bad. We can deal with it.
That's right.
So it's always interesting how you need to get back and have a perspective.
That's right.
Another thing I think is strategic thinkers, I think, are why-based thinkers, they're always inquisitive. They're asking, well, why is that like that? Why does that have to be that way? Why couldn't we do it differently? Why can't we have a different perspective? And that's related to this new views on old news.
Yes.
But it's a person that typically asks the question why and doesn't accept, well, that's the way we've always done it. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
In a strategic thinker.
You know,
and remember, strategic thinkers are learners. They are people who don't know it all. They are people who are constantly strive to learn, people who are surrounding themselves with fresh ideas. You know, one of the hardest things to do as a flag officer in the United States Navy, I used to tell people, is to get to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
People will tell you anything in order to make you happy. It's also something I call a limited line of sight. The more senior you get, the more you are subject to the whims of your staff. They only let you see what they want you to see. A strategic thinker is someone who doesn't let themselves be bounded by the views of their staff and what the staff wants them to see. They're inquisitive. They're out. They're learning. They're talking to new and different people, and it creates panic among the staff.
Yes, I imagine that would. So, Admiral, how do you train your staff and those subordinates to think like this? Because obviously people become stovepipes. They get stuck within a particular line and are unable to think outside the box, but you're asking them to do just that. So how do you find those people? How do you encourage them to do this? Do you have a particular method that you would use to encourage your staff, to encourage their staffs to?
Well, number one, you lead by example.
Yes, sir.
And you demonstrate that you value these visions of people, you know, on your staff who don't necessarily take the status quo. You know, you value their opinions. I think one of the biggest things you can do is not to shoot the messenger. I used to tell people on my personal staff that I had a no dope policy. If I was going to do anything dopey, it was their responsibility to step up and say, Admiral, think about that again. I'm not sure that passes the test.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I worked for the Secretary of the Navy, I sat in for almost 3 years on every single decision that was made regarding the United States Navy and the Marine Corps, quite frankly. And I never walked out of that office thinking that we made a bad decision. But if I had a nickel for every time someone came back to me and said, well, that was a dumb decision because, you know, X, Y, Z, and, you know, I would say, well, heck, if we'd known that, then we would have probably done something different. How is it that you didn't let us know this? Why, you know, I'm only the executive assistant to the Secretary of the Navy, the next to the last person to ever find out about anything in the Navy, because usually somebody would tell me, and then I'd go in and tell the Secretary. So, you know, don't keep secrets around here, and I think having an open policy is the way to go. I used to be very impressed. I was privileged to work for Richard Danzig when he was the Secretary of the Navy. And I was so impressed with the way that he would prepare for a speech, for instance. Rather than have his speechwriter write the speech and do the research, what Secretary Danzig would do is bring in a group of senior officers and just sit around the table and discuss whatever the topic of the speech was going to be. But then what he'd do after that was he would go out and round up some junior officers and some enlisted people and come in and sit with them and talk to him about what it was that they were that he was going to talk about. So he'd get a wide variety of views. And so I think one of the things you have to do in your staff is make sure that they're encouraged to speak up and provide that information. I think also you're going to have to give your staff a little bit of headroom to do things and let them have some responsibility and give them a little bit of room to maneuver. And, you know, a lot of times a classic example of this is messages. You know, I consider myself the consummate naval message writer when I was operational, for instance, like particularly when I was a battle group commander, and I had a specific way that I'd like to write my messages. And my staff would bring me messages, and although I just had this burning desire to break out the red pen and just start slashing all over the place. You know, I resisted the temptation to do so. And if it got the point across, fine. If it wasn't wrong, you know, you have to let them learn a little bit. Yeah. So those are a couple of tips I would give.
This is the end of track one of two tracks. If you'd like more information on our podcast webinars and other activities and resources, please visit www.thinkingstrategically.net. And now, I would like to remind you to go read critically, think critically, and go lead enthusiastically.